Crossing a corridor, the two men escorted Mildred into a broad chamber whose walls were veiled by heavy tapestries, embroidered with scenes of dark-skinned people involved in all sorts of activities, most of them lascivious. The men released Mildred and backed out of the room, shutting a wooden door inlaid with ivory and chased with gold leaf. When she heard the unmistakable sound of a lock, she stood for a moment, rubbing feeling back into her wrists, and studied the chamber. It wasn't very spacious, but it was nicely appointed, with a low, highly varnished table, a couple of chairs, and a curtained alcove. Padding over to the alcove, Mildred tugged the curtain aside. She saw a sunken tub, surrounded by a white stone rim. As she considered drawing a bath, she heard the door lock turn. She saw a woman enter, holding several folded articles of clothing in her arms. Tall, slim, and lithe, moving with the soundless grace of a panther, the woman returned Mildred's stare with impersonal, black-outlined eyes. Her features were haughty and imperious, yet sensual, with a touch of ruthlessness about the full lips. She was dressed simply in a brief frock that left her arms and legs bare, the material so gauzy that her small breasts and black pubic triangle were only slightly blurred, not obscured. Jewels glittered and winked on her slim throat and slender wrists.
"Who are you?"
The woman gazed at her speculatively, inclined her head toward the door, and listened intently.
"What is your name?"
"Wyeth. Mildred Winona Wyeth."
"You must bathe and get dressed. Mimsies awaits you."
"Who?"
"The High Counselor of Otten. He's heard about you. He wants to see you immediately."
"Let him wait. I asked you who you are, remember?"
"A friend."
"That's great. I can use one in this place. Does my friend have a name?"
"I am Nephrin. You must trust me."
"Nephrin? Pharaoh's rebellious daughter?"
"I had nothing to do with the uprising. I was used as a rallying point during my father's self-imposed exile. I accepted Pharaoh's decision."
"Even when he disowned you?"
"Who told you that?"
"It doesn't matter. Besides, you're just a kid."
"I am 16. That is quite old in this kingdom. Old enough to do what must be done. Now, do what I say."
"Why should I? Where are my friends? Are they alive?"
"You must be quiet. If the guards think you are giving me a difficult time, they'll come in and bathe you themselves. I don't think you'd like that, would you?"
"Not particularly. But answer my questions."
"The red-haired woman is alive, held here in another part of the palace."
"And the men? What will happen to them?"
"What are their names?"
"Ryan Calder, Theophilus Algernon Tanner. He answers to Doc, and John Barrymore Dix."
"They will be well treated, at least for a while."
"And Jack, the young one?"
"He was not captured."
"Do you know where he is?"
Nephrin shook her head and pushed Mildred gently toward the alcove. She went to the tub and turned on the faucet.
"I do not know where he is at present. That ignorance is of my choice and for his own safety, as well as mine and yours. When the time is appropriate, I will find out, and so will you. Now, we must stop wasting time."
Mildred hesitated, locking eyes with Nephrin. They were dark, even darker than her own, but she saw a glint of red swirling in those sepia depths. Shuddering inwardly, Mildred stepped into the tub. In spite of her fear, anger, and anxiety, she was happy for the opportunity to wash away 2 days' worth of dried sweat and grit in the warm, rose-scented water.
"It will take too much time to remove the beads and comb out all your braids. Mimsies will just have to get used to a different hairstyle for women."
"Why am I supposed to meet this Mimsies?"
"As I said, when he heard a black woman had been captured, he ordered you to be brought before him. He is very important, very powerful, second only to my father in his influence over Otten. When you go before him, you must curb your tongue and not anger him."
"Why?"
"Pharaoh has left the decision of what to do with you and your friends in Mimsy's hands. Unfortunately, since you killed so many incarnates, he's tempted to torture all of you to death."
"Even Christy? The red-haired woman?"
"No. Her fate has already been decided. By Pharaoh."
"Why am I not surprised?"
"One last thing, Mildred Winona Wyeth. When you're in with Mimsies, do not think of anything I have told you. Send your thoughts in another direction."
"Why don't you just ask me to think about elephants?"
"What?"
"When you ask someone not to think of something, invariably the first thing they think about is what they're not supposed to think about. Is Mimsy's a psychic or a telepath or something along those lines?
Not exactly. But he to whom Mimsy's is answerable...
The counselor awaits the Outland woman.
Mildred quickly rose from the tub, water cascading down her body. Nephron handed her the garments, and she dressed in them quickly. When she had put them on, Mildred looked down at herself. Instead of a frock or a skirt, she wore a broad strip of purple cloth fastened to a leather belt girding her hips. Another strip at the back fell to her upper thighs. Circular cups made of thin, gilt-edged leather barely covered her breasts, exposing a good amount of cleavage. High-strapped sandals completed the costume.
Somebody has got to be kidding. Who does he think I am? Scheherazade the dancing girl? I'm not really built for this outfit.
That's for sure. No time to make up your eyes with coal, but your eyelashes are long enough as it is. Besides, you've got good bone structure. You're very pretty for a woman so old.
Thanks. Did Mimsy's pick out this ensemble?
Yes, but consider yourself lucky. Usually the women he calls for aren't allowed to wear anything at all.
Come on.
Mildred obediently crossed the chamber, feeling like a contestant in a Miss Belly Dancing contest. Before stepping through the door, she cast a glance over her shoulder. Nephron stared after her, her eyes burning with a strange, indecipherable light. The two men marched on either side of Mildred, this time not laying a hand on her. At the end of the corridor, they ascended a winding staircase that led directly to a great, high-ceilinged hall. The hall attested to the wealth and power of its owner, not just by its size, but by the richness of the furnishings. Lotus-topped pillars upheld the high ceiling, and smoldering bronze braziers filled the air with a spicy, aromatic scent. The polished surfaces of the walls bore a confusing jumble of pictographs and symbols and colors, bright reds, vivid greens, deep cyans, brilliant yellows. Plush chairs, divans, and settees were scattered about, laid out and arranged so the eye followed the furniture to the open terrace at the far wall. Late afternoon sunlight shafted down on a heavy-set black man reclining on a cushion-piled dais. His gray-sprinkled hair was blunt-cut and very short. He wore a linen tunic that exposed arms and legs that had once been firm with muscle, but were now sagging with flab. His deeply lined face had a sensual lupine quality about it. His eyes were almost hidden by puffy bags of flesh. A supple-bodied girl, barely into her teens, knelt behind him, massaging his neck and shoulders. Her fingers moved deftly and expertly. When Mildred drew closer, she saw that his youthful masseuse was stark naked, except for hieroglyphic designs painted on her arms, legs, and budding breasts. A pair of huge men, one wearing the head of a jackal and the other the head of a bull, stood on opposite ends of the terrace. Both gripped Mata'u staves in their fists. Mildred's two-man escort suddenly halted, turned smartly on their heels, and strode back to the door.
Get over here, woman. You kept me waiting long enough.
Mildred hesitantly edged onto the terrace, then to the base of the cushion-heaped dais. She locked her gaze on his face, dark eye to dark eye. His strength shone nakedly in his eyes, but it was an ugly strength, devoted only to fulfilling his own wants and whims. His eyes bored into hers, as though they were trying to gauge her own strength. Remembering Nephron's warning, she sent her thoughts skittering in different directions, tumbling over one another. For a woman with such a disciplined mind, she found it difficult to allow chaos to fill her thoughts, but she managed. She knew the man expected her to turn away, so she met his expectations and cast her glance down.
Genuine brown sugar. Real color by birth, not by a fucking bottle. What's your name, brown sugar?
Mildred.
I'm Mimsy's. Not my real name, of course, but it'll do.
What is your real name?
Stockbridge. Mean anything to you?
No.
Thought not. I was a nothing at Stockbridge. Goddamn fairer. Not worth a rat's fart in a hurricane. Mimsy's is a different story altogether. You a pretty woman, you know that? Kind of stocky, but I like you. Built for strength and breeding. Lovely and a real brown. Yeah, a real lovely brown.
Mimsy's right hand stole beneath the hem of his tunic and moved slowly back and forth.
Stop it, you goddamn pervert!
I haven't gotten going yet, Mildred.
Mimsies withdrew his hand and pushed himself to his feet. Mildred noted a brief metallic gleam beneath his tunic. She watched him step off the platform, smile at her, then draw back his right hand. Mildred knew the psychology behind Mimsy's display. It wasn't about sex at all, but about control and power. She had only two options at the moment. For the sake of her pride, she could plant her foot where Mimsy's hand had been a few moments before, but she would probably die, or end up wishing she had. Or she could feign humility and fear.
Please, I'll do what you want.
Of course you will, brown sugar. You better not give me any more of this pervert bullshit, or I'll rip your bowels out and make you feed them to the work gangs. I decide what's perverted around here and what's not. You understand me?
Yes, sir.
Where did you and your friends come from? Where'd you get your blasters?
They're not really my friends. They had weapons when I joined up with them about a month ago. They kind of just forced me to fall in with them. You know how it is with scavengers living off the land. We came across the barrens. We almost died, all of us.
Mimsy's regarded her silently for a long moment. Then he pounded his right fist hard into Mildred's bare midriff. She was only dimly aware of falling to the cold, slick floor.
You're fucking lying to me, brown sugar. You were in Fort Fubar and killed my incarnates to get their chariot. You have any idea how hard it is to train new recruits? You and your scavenger friends chill the cream of the cream. It took 3 years to train them. And you left them to lie like so much vulture's meat. Worse, you did it in front of the citizens. You've handed me a real, what's the old term? Public relations nightmare. You were in Pharaoh's tomb, too. I'd have tossed you into the Incarnate's barracks so they can have a little fun with you. And if there's anything left of your lovely hide, I'll strip it off an inch at a time. Make myself a new pair of sandals with it. Get her out of here. Take her to the women's quarters, but keep her isolated. I'll talk to that old bag of bones after supper.
Mildred felt hands close around her upper arms and heave her up to her feet. The two men hustled her away from the terrace and out of the hall. Mildred was escorted into a corridor that led off to the left from Mimsy's hall. The passageway wasn't very broad, but it was long. She noted an absence of guards prowling the corridors. She could only presume that Pharaoh was so confident in his power, he saw no reason for security forces other than the Incarnates. The men turned Mildred right at an intersection and stopped before a door bound with strips of brass. A small wicket in the door slid open, and a dusky face peered out with bland eyes.
Open up, Grandmother. Mimsy's wants this woman looked after, but locked away from the rest of your bitches.
The wicket snapped shut, and an instant later the door swung wide. One of her escorts planted a hand between her shoulder blades and propelled her over the threshold. Mildred whirled and just managed to bite back a cry of revulsion. A woman stood beside the door, her incredibly obese body covered with a linen kaftan that covered her from neck to ankle. Only her arms were bare, two shapeless masses of flesh ending in blunt-fingered hands. Her features had long ago blurred into a sagging mass. Her hair was thin and white and hung about her shoulders like a tattered shroud.
We haven't had a new arrival in a long time. Everybody here calls me Grandmother. What are you called?
Mildred.
Well, Mildred, if you do as I say, we'll get along fine. Come with me.
In a shambling, lumbering gait, Grandmother led the way through a series of doorless, box-shaped chambers. Torches burned here and there along the walls, and by their flickering, smoky glare, Mildred saw rows upon rows of narrow cots and many, many women, most of them so young they were still girls. They were engaged in all manner of activities, sewing, sweeping, scrubbing the floors, or stretched out on the cot, sleeping the sleep of the utterly exhausted. She saw very little modesty among the sea of girls. Most of the women walked, worked, and talked in the nude. Mildred understood she was in the dormitory for the female servant class of the city, not the handmaidens of ranking citizens such as Mimsy's, but the drudges, the cooks, the scullery maids. Their situation probably wasn't as extreme as slavery, but it wasn't very many notches above that state either. Mildred followed the jiggling bulk of Grandmother down an aisle formed by two parallel lines of large wooden tubs. A few women soaked in them, while others sponged an oily brown substance over their bodies.
At least you won't need a treatment before you're sent out to perform your duties.
What is that stuff? Some kind of vegetable-derived stain?
It's the color of Aten, the people of Pharaoh. That's all you need to know.
Granny, you don't have the color of Aten. Is that why you're down here, as the serving girl wardess?
A good guess. We serve Pharaoh when and where we can. You'll come to appreciate that.
You're one of the original crew of Fort Fubar, aren't you?
We don't speak of that blasphemous half-acre of hell, child. It's forbidden.
Mildred started to say something else, then shut her mouth. Grandmother stopped before a low open doorway. It was hardly tall enough for Mildred to step through without stooping, and that made it very low indeed.
Here's your room, child. It's all yours. You don't have to share it with anyone else. At least until I'm told otherwise.
It was very dark inside the cell, but Mildred took a determined breath, bent her head, and walked in. A small barred grille at eye level on the door allowed a feeble sort of light to filter through. The cell was about 8 feet wide and 12 feet long. There was no cot or pallet to sleep on, but it did have a toilet and tank in one corner. She sat down on the hard stone floor and rubbed her eyes. Though she couldn't know for sure, she doubted the woman's dormitory was part of the original movie set blueprints, despite DeMille's legendary reputation as a strict taskmaster. 16 years was more than enough time to build additions and tinker with the original specs. But the building materials had to come from somewhere, especially the stone used in the pyramids. Mildred couldn't work off her stress by pacing the cell, so eventually she lay on the floor, pillowing her head on her arms. In spite of her anxiety, she fell asleep. She was jarred awake, almost immediately it seemed, by the sound of the door's locking bar. She sat up, blinking, stiff and aching from sleeping on the hard floor. The door swung open, and a slim girl in a white frock came in, carrying a wicker tray containing a bowl of some kind of soup, a wooden spoon, a thick slice of darkish bread, and a jug of water. The girl knelt, carefully placing the tray on the floor in front of Mildred. Like all the rest, she had black hair and a dusky-hued complexion. However, her eyes were pale, perhaps gray or a light blue. A touch of pink lipstick brightened her mouth.
What time is it?
The dawn bell has just been rung. Here's breakfast. My name is Kayla. Nefren sent me to bring you word of the one called Jack.
Christy opened her eyes and stared in wonder at the chamber around her. Silk tapestries adorned the walls, rich rugs were on the floors, and the ivory chairs, benches, and divans were littered with satin cushions. The canopy over the bed in which she lay was hung with gauzy draperies, softly stirred by an intoxicatingly sweet breeze, scented like orange blossoms. Christy suddenly bolted upright, pushing herself into a sitting position. Memories returned to her in a flooding rush. The redoubt, the trek, the fight, and finally the capture. She looked around wildly. The chamber was identical to the one in her jump dream, and for a split second, her careening thoughts turned to the possibility that she was still hallucinating. She looked toward the great bronze double doors at the far end of the room. As in her dream, she saw no knobs or handles. Climbing out of the bed, she saw that she was naked. Snatching up the brightly colored bedspread and draping it around her, she saw that the chamber walls were made of huge, white-faced stone blocks, perhaps limestone. The ceiling was exceptionally high, light shafted through slot-like skylights filtered by the colored panes of glass. There were wall hangings with designs that complemented those of the bedspread. The furniture was of varnished wood, of an extremely advanced level of craftsmanship. She walked cautiously to the massive double doors. She heard nothing on the other side of them and started to turn away. Christy dropped into a combat stance, clenching her right fist, stiffening her left wrist, locking the fingers in a half-curled position against the palm so as to deliver a leopard's paw strike. One of the doors opened just enough to admit a young woman. She wore a short linen tunic and her shining black hair framed a startlingly beautiful face. She carried a covered tray of food in her hands. Appearing not to notice Christie's fighting posture, she smiled wanly and walked past her to place the tray on a low table.
How are you feeling?
Who are you? Where am I?
One question at a time. To answer your second question first, you are in Aten, in the guest chamber of Pharaoh's palace. As for your first, I have been sent to see to your wants. My name is Nephron.
Where are my friends?
They are here, separated from you, but safe. If you wish them to remain so, you must listen carefully and trust that I will tell you the truth. Sit and eat. I am sure you are very hungry. You have been resting for nearly 6 hours. I will tell you what I can.
Christie realized then that she was famished, so she selected an assortment of fruit and sweetmeats from the plates.
How are you called?
Christie Roth.
Christie Roth, you are the guest of Akhenaten. He foresaw your arrival here.
How?
He has the ability to sense thoughts, especially thoughts charged with emotions. He can direct the thoughts he senses to run in channels of his own choosing. When you and your friends came into the range of his influence, he sensed your ka, your soul, immediately.
He can read minds, then?
He can sense, in a general fashion, the substance of your mind. So you must be very careful what you think and what you allow yourself to feel when you come before him. Do you understand?
To an extent. What I don't understand is why I've been isolated from the rest of my party.
Pharaoh has singled you out, as I'm sure you guessed.
Singled me out why? To add to his harem?
Oh, Pharaoh does not have a harem. He leaves such indulgences to his counselors, like Mimsy's. No, I imagine Pharaoh has a greater destiny for you in mind.
Nephron, I've got to get out of here now. I don't know if I can screen him out if he's as powerful as he seems to be.
I know, Christie Roth. However, take solace in the knowledge that I'm trying to help you and your friends. You must have patience and trust in me.
All right. I don't have many options.
We are all in this together, Christie, bound to each other. You must use all your strength and resist Pharaoh's desires. He will bend your body and mind to his purposes and leave you an empty husk, as he left my mother.
Where is Ryan?
The one-eyed man.
Yes, I must talk to him.
Oh, that is not possible. I can perhaps relay a message from you to him.
When? How?
When the opportunity arises. How is my own affair. Now, it is time to get ready for your meeting with Pharaoh.
Nephron showed Christie a door, hidden behind a decorative wall panel. Behind it was a lavishly appointed dressing room with a bathing area. The tub was more like a small pool, sunken into the floor, about 6 feet in diameter. It was rimmed with ceramic tiles, a gorgeous shade of turquoise, and the fixtures appeared to be solid silver. Nephron showed Christie how to control the flow of water, and where all the soaps, perfumes, and lotions were stored. She withdrew into the bedchamber while Christie dropped her covering and walked down the 3 steps into the foaming bath. She settled down in a cradle-like seat at the far corner of the tub and washed herself, even shampooing her long hair. Despite herself, she felt tension ebb from her limbs and mind. A part of her marveled that she was able to relax under the circumstances. She thought of Tirawa and how happy she and Ryan had been there. Floating on those thoughts, buoyed by the scented water, Christie almost drifted off to sleep. Her hair straightened languidly as she remembered the few short days she had spent in the valley with Ryan. Slowly, the image of Ryan dissolved, the eye patch and scar melting away. The figure who took his place was still tall and dark-haired, and her lover, but his eyes glowed crimson.
Ah!
She sat up with a start. Though the water was still warm, she felt very cold. She stood, climbed out of the tub, toweled herself off, and dried her hair. Nephron entered with a garment folded over her arm.
I forgot to leave this before. You are so beautiful already, Christie, but we need to make you more presentable for Pharaoh.
How do you do that stuff on your eyes?
It is called kohl. That black pencil there. Shall I show you how?
Christie nodded, ignoring the faraway voice, shouting a dim warning in her head. She allowed Nephron to skillfully apply the cosmetics to her face, and within minutes, she looked very different. With her eyelids outlined in black, her large green eyes seemed huge, with an innocent yet aristocratic expression in them. Nefren painted her lips a deep red and used a blush to accentuate her high cheekbones. She allowed the girl to swab her with a perfume that smelled like the sweetest of garden flowers. Then she put on the dress that Nefren had brought. It was a high-waisted white gown that plunged at the neck almost to her navel. The right side was slit to above the thigh, but at least the material wasn't the semi-transparent gauze worn by Nefren. She put on bracelets and rings, and Nefren slid a collar of beaten gold around her slender neck.
Pharaoh will be pleased.
I wasn't thinking about dressing for him. I don't want... What's wrong with me? Why should I dress up like a gaudy slut for a man who's keeping me a prisoner? This isn't me.
For the time being, it must be. Christy, if you can make Pharaoh believe you are who he wants you to be, he will treat you and your friends kindly.
Who does he want me to be?
That you will learn. I cannot prepare you for it.
This is a charade. It's like I forgot that or something.
We need time to make our plans for your escape. You can buy us that time.
This could get out of control. I know what's happening. I'm already responding to the bastard's psychic cues.
You must be strong now that you are aware of them.
All right, Nefren. I just want to get this over with. I want Pharaoh to let us leave.
As do we all. Now, he is ready for you.
That's what I was afraid you were going to say.
Nefren led Christy into a very broad corridor. High up in the vaulted ceiling, skylights like the ones in the bedchamber let in colored sunlight. Two balustrated galleries ran along each side of the corridor, one above the other. They turned into an open door.
Pharaoh Akhenaten.
Christy hadn't been sure of what to expect, but the chamber into which she was escorted was almost Spartan in its furnishings. It certainly wasn't a throne room or royal living quarters. It was more like a study or a library. Shelves laden with books and bound volumes of magazines covered two walls. A work table held the tools and materials of a sculptor. Clay, stone, chisels, and delicate picks. A huge pre-dark map of the United States hung on the far wall. Christy noted that large sections of it had been altered by red ink, no doubt to make it conform to the geophysical changes since the new cost. The man seated at an ornately carved desk was a stranger, yet when he stood, she knew with a sick sinking sensation in her stomach that she had seen him before. He looked to be in his mid-30s. His black hair was short-cropped and his shoulders almost impossibly broad. He wore only a brown gilt-edged vest and a white linen kilt, which showed off his deeply tanned muscled arms and legs. However, it was the deep red hue of his big eyes that captured Christie's attention. He stared at her silently for a long moment, then stepped toward her. It wasn't until he was next to her that she realized just how tall he was. At 1 inch shy of 6 feet, she was hardly petite, but he truly towered over her, not just in height, but in breadth.
I must have the name to which you presently answer.
Christy.
Christy, please forgive the manner in which we meet again, but the circumstances dictated it to be the only way.
How should I address you?
You may call me Akhenaten. There's no need for the two of us to stand on formalities. I feel I know you intimately.
Rather than saying anything, Christy walked around him to a chair facing the desk and sat in it. Akhenaten returned to his seat behind the desk.
What did you mean about meeting me again?
Are you telling me you don't remember? Oh, well, that's unimportant. All that matters is you are here now, when the monument nears completion. Would you like something to drink?
That would be very nice.
Akhenaten closed his eyes for the briefest of moments. When he opened them, Nefren came through the door.
You wish something, Pharaoh?
Dandelion wine. The batch from 3 summers ago.
By your command.
The woman quickly went to a cabinet across the room and removed a corked earthenware bottle and 2 goblets. She brought them to Akhenaten's desk, allowing the Pharaoh to remove the cork with a negligent twist of thumb and forefinger. Nefren filled the goblets, handed one to Christy, then lingered by her chair.
You may go.
Nefren bowed her head again and left the room. She steadfastly avoided making eye contact with Christy. Akhenaten sipped the wine and cast Christy a questioning look. She tasted it found it sweet with just a hint of bitter aftertaste, but more than palatable overall. Akhenaten placed the goblet on the desk, and his eyes gazed directly into hers.
Now that the wine has cleansed our palates of falsehoods, let us speak truthfully and plainly, shall we?
Yes, we shall.
I knew our individual roads of destiny would converge at this time.
Destiny? I'm not sure if I understand you.
My monument could not be completed without your presence, but I continue to build it, knowing you would arrive before the capstone ceremony. And you have.
A strange coincidence. I can't deny that.
Coincidence, Christy. I've searched for you for many years.
Why?
Because you are my fated queen. Now, as always, we have always been together. When I, as Amenhotep, took the name of Akhenaten, I took you to wife.
When was this?
At the height of the glorious 18th dynasty, over 3,000 years ago, give or take a decade or two. Your name was Nefertiti. You know that, don't you? You have the same psychic memory as I, stretching back over the long track and tide of time. You and I have been reborn many, many times, and always have we been together.
I belong to another.
As did I. Merely way stops on the road of fate. Temporary patches on the wounds of loneliness. Always I knew my Ka mate was coming. It was hard to be patient, but I was. I waited, and here you are, at last.
You said we would speak the truth to one another.
So I did.
Then let us do so, without dragging souls, destiny, and past lives into the mix. I was in the redoubt where you were born, or created. There was another like you, a female. She died. I found out about you, about O'Brien, about Harrier. Somehow, when my friends and I jumped into the redoubt, you got into our heads. Ryan, Doc, and most of all, me. You were testing us from here, finding out who was the most psi-sensitive, and you locked in on me. Your abilities are like mine, operating on an empathic level rather than telepathic. You made me perform for you. Later, when we tried to leave, you kept the Mattrans chamber from working. Psychokinesis?
Yes. After many years of practice, I possess a small degree of it.
Have I spoken the truth?
You have. Your perception of it, at least.
Then speak of your perception. Why have you done all of this?
I believe I explained that.
You explained nothing. I possess a limited precognitive gift, but for you to have known well in advance that one day I would appear in your redoubt is too thin for me to consider the truth.
Slowly, Akhenaten rose from the desk and paced over to his work table. A closed cabinet hung on the wall above it. He opened the door panel.
Look at this, Christy. Look.
Inside the cabinet rested a life-size painted bust of a woman. Her face was smoothly contoured, the cheekbones high, the nose straight and finely chiseled, the chin round and firm. The mouth was straight with a full lower lip. The slender column of a throat was long and graceful. Above a high, smooth forehead rested a cylindrical, flat-topped headpiece, concealing all the hair. But beneath curved brows, the wide, slightly tilted eyes were a brilliant green. Christy felt as if she were looking into a mirror, rather than inspecting a piece of statuary.
This is an exact copy of a bust found in a workshop in Akhenaten's royal palace. The original was over 3,000 years old. Historians agreed that it is probably the only true likeness of Akhenaten's queen, Nefertiti.
Christy drained the last of the dandelion wine as Akhenaten closed the cabinet door and regarded her quietly.
What do you expect me to say?
That you will at least contemplate the possibility that your spirit, your Ka and mine, were meant to meet again. That we are fated to rule as god and goddess over this blighted planet.
I can't contemplate anything. Not when I'm so concerned about my friends.
They mean much to you.
Yes. Especially Ryan.
The one-eyed man.
Yes.
He is a true warrior, that one. The Ka, the leopard, lives within him. However, Aten has no need of leopards or warriors. There may be no place for him or your friends.
If there is no place for them, there is no place for me.
Akhenaten returned her gaze for a long, speculative moment, then returned to his chair behind the desk.
My High Counselor, Mimsies, took responsibility for containing your people. I will speak to him, though he is very angry over the losses you caused him.
Losses?
The Incarnates.
As he had a few minutes before, Akhenaten closed his eyes, and a moment later, Nefren came into the study.
Fetch Mimsies. Bring him here immediately.
The girl ducked her head and left the room.
Was that telepathy just now?
You mean with Nefren?
Yes, you closed your eyes and she...
There are certain minds I can touch. Minds with which I can establish psychic links. Not very many, because the other mind must possess a certain degree of psionic abilities as well. Nefren is one. You, obviously, are another.
And you can't influence Psi-Null minds unless they're unwary or unguarded.
Or asleep.
An overweight black man entered the chamber, head at a deferential posture.
You wish to see me, Pharaoh?
Akhenaten asked him several questions about Christie's friends.
I interviewed a woman named Mildred. She lied to me about herself and the others.
She was afraid.
I intend to question the others.
No need. Where is this Mildred now?
In the Hall of Women, in isolation.
Release her and the rest of the newcomers. Send Iwat to begin their education.
Lord Pharaoh, two matters must be addressed. First, one of their group is still at large. An incarnate was found in Baltic Alley. He had been stabbed to death.
Continue the search for him. My order to take him alive still stands.
The second matter is of murder and reparation. Eight of my incarnates have been slaughtered. Six are missing, and I presume them dead.
There will be reparation.
Akhenaten gestured toward the door. Mimsies bowed, gave Christie a grudging nod, and stalked out of the study.
What did you mean by education?
If your friends are to remain among us, they must learn our customs, our beliefs, our ways.
I don't suppose that simply letting us return to the redoubt and jump out of here is an option.
No, it is not. The people who come among us learn to live by our ways, or they don't live at all.
When may I see my friends, then?
Soon.
Akhenaten stood and walked toward her, extending a hand. After a hesitant moment, she took it and allowed him to gently pull her to her feet.
You must absorb what you have learned. Nefren will take you back to your quarters. We will speak again tomorrow.
Then swiftly, unexpectedly, Akhenaten pulled Christie against him. He bent his head and whispered into her ear.
He came to her straight away. He was ardent for her. He gave his heart unto her. Let her see him in the form of a god after he came before her.
As swiftly as he had embraced her, he released her, guiding her out into the corridor. Nefren stood there, her mouth set in a tight, grim line. A dew of sweat had gathered at Christie's temples, and she realized she was moist elsewhere. Looking down at herself, she was shamed and a little shocked to see her nipples hard and hot, poking against the thin fabric covering her breasts.
Let us go.
Christie tried to engage Nefren in conversation on the walk back to her chambers, but the girl refused to speak until they were behind closed doors.
He's not what I expected.
Christie, be on your guard. His power is working on you too quickly. If you are seduced before...
I've done what you told me to do. Nobody, not Pharaoh, Baron, or God, will seduce me. You wanted me to buy you some time by playing nice. Did I or didn't I?
I apologize. I spoke out of turn. But you must always keep in mind the power he can bring to bear. It's not a simple matter of Pharaoh wanting to have his way. He always has his way. Just remember to guard your thoughts and your dreams.
Ryan, Doc, and JB had spent a relatively miserable night in their cells. Relatively, because they could easily recall worse nights spent in far worse places. Still, they were a long way from being comfortable. The bald turnkeys gave them food at one point, something resembling cold oatmeal, and water. But they steadfastly refused to answer questions, or to even respond to the insults JB hurled at them. He addressed them as Baldy 1 and Baldy 2, but they ignored him. As the hours dragged on, Ryan's strength slowly returned to him, the pain fading. And with it, faded the emotional memory of the red-eyed giant's voice. Ryan replayed Danielson's words in his mind.
When you're in the presence of Pharaoh, you end up loving him eventually.
He touched the blood-crested welt on the side of his head, and thought of the man who had inflicted it.
No love lost here. That bastard has to pay.
A young woman came hurrying into the cell blocks, carrying a basket full of dark loaves of bread. As one, Doc, JB, and Ryan stepped back from the bars, unconsciously covering themselves. She swept her gaze over the men, then rested it on Ryan. She stepped forward, thrusting a long loaf between the bars.
My name is Kayla. I bring word of your missing friends.
They listened quietly as she told them of the whereabouts of Jack, Mildred, and Christy.
Don't worry. Christy is all right. She is a guest in the palace under the personal protection of Pharaoh.
What the hell do you mean?
She is your woman, isn't she? You have no need to worry yet. Christy is prepared for his probes.
What?
Psychic probes, Ryan Cardor. Yes, I know your name. I know all of your names, and I and others intend to help you.
Why are you befriending us at such great personal risk?
It is a long story. But keep in mind that forces are at work to free you. In the meantime, you are scheduled to be released from your cells shortly. That should give you some comfort. But you must not try to leave the city, and you must cooperate with everyone who deals with you. If you do not, every one of you will be killed.
With a swirl of her hair, Kayla turned and left the cell block.
Now, who in this den of holiness would care about heretics such as ourselves?
You think we should believe her?
Well, we'll wait and see. That's all we can do. At least we know Jack and Christy are alive. That's something.
Within the hour, the turnkey strode in, tossing folded squares of linen into the cells.
Put these on. You're moving to new accommodations.
It took them a couple of minutes to figure out the proper way to wear the kilts. When Doc pointed out that they were like oversized diapers, they adjusted them accordingly. After they were dressed, the cell doors were unlocked, and they walked out under the scrutiny of the turnkeys. The turnkeys appeared unarmed. JB shot Ryan an up from under questioning glance, but the one-eyed man shook his head. Starting a fight in such closed quarters wouldn't gain them anything. They followed Baldy 1 down the corridor, while Baldy 2 dogged their heels. They walked out into the cold sunlight of dawn, marching across a walled-in compound. Interest temporarily displaced Ryan's other concerns. In the center of the yard was an array of very large, open-topped, wheeled metal cubes, resting on a double-rail track. Men wearing apron-like garments fed fires beneath the cubes, and other men stood over them, using long-handled paddles to stir the contents. An odd smell, like lime combined with acid, bit into Ryan's nostrils. The men wielding the paddles wore strips of cloth over nose and mouth. A line of men formed a bucket brigade, passing containers full of rock chips to other men, who dumped their contents into the metal cubes. Several other laborers poured the contents of sacks into the gooey, putty-like mix. Another group of men used mallets to pulverize cactus lobes laid out on big squares of muslin, pounding them to pulp. The entire operation was very organized, very efficient, like an assembly line. The three outlanders were herded into a building on the far side of the compound. The guards guided them to a room that contained furniture. It was simple, but much appreciated by Doc, who flopped down in a thickly upholstered chair. A dark, polished table stood in the middle of the room, and beside the table stood a dark, polished, plushy man in his mid-twenties, soft-faced with limpid, liquid brown eyes. He wore a green and white ankle-length mantle cinched at the waist by a gold-tasseled cord. The toes poking out from beneath the hem of his mantle were painted a shocking pink. An opal the size of a robin's egg hung from one fleshy earlobe. His short black hair was a mass of tight curls.
You may go, but remain outside.
The guards obediently left the room.
My name is Ewart. I'm to be your instructor in the customs of Aten. I serve as scribe and scholar in the court of Pharaoh. You will listen to me, and you will learn.
Well, let's get on with it, then.
We shall, when the other member of your party arrives.
As if on cue, a scantily clad black woman stepped through the door. Everyone stared at her in nonplussed silence for a heartbeat. Then JB rushed to her.
Mildred? Dark Knight, Mildred!
They embraced and kissed passionately. Then JB held her at arm's length and looked her up and down.
Where'd you get that rig?
Costume of the day.
My, Dr. Wyeth, don't you look as professional and as medical as can be. I'd let you freeze me anytime.
Look who's talking, Dr. Tanner. Past time for your diapers to be changed, isn't it?
Please, people, please. We must begin so you can be assigned to your individual duties.
What do you mean by that?
Listen and learn. Akhenaten has been reborn into the world, to be Pharaoh of the world. I only tell you what mystics knew ages ago. That the savior of humanity was coming, Akhenaten, to whom all the peoples of the world will one day bow their necks. Akhenaten's powers derive from Osiris, and with the gods' help he is building an empire, a dynasty that will last 10,000 years, and all who took part in forging it will share in the benefits. It will be once again as it was in the before times. Our people will spread out from Aten, bringing the word of Akhenaten into the wastelands. We will reshape this world and make certain that the evil that sprouted in it never grows again. Pharaoh will unite all the different peoples and tribes. All will join us. And the old divisions of race, nationalism, and sexual preference that nearly destroyed the world will be forgotten.
Hell Eyes is going to conquer the world with the force of his personality?
Do not use that term. It is forbidden, and carries with it ghastly penalties.
As you wish. However, the question still stands.
The force of his personality, you ask? Yes, you might say that. And the Sakum energy that will be his to command once the pyramid is completed.
Those sticks the incarnates used, that's an example of the whatchamacallit energy?
The sticks channel Mena energy, which is the opposite of Sakum. The Mena effects are debilitating, not fatal. We seldom use lethal weapons.
That's real decent of you.
Pharaoh is benevolent by nature. He wishes only to pass on the blessings of his kingdom to all his subjects. When new subjects like you and your friends come among us, we show you the many benefits to be gained from living as a citizen of Aten.
Such as?
Security, lack of want, shelter, education, and a purpose in life. We remold people like you into the ideal Aten form. You are educated and corrected.
Corrected? You mean brainwashed?
Of course not. By correcting, I mean that all the unproductive habits and attitudes are tweaked and rechanneled into productivity. In Aten, all people know they are part of something larger, something better than they are. They work toward a common goal, willingly. You will come to see how working together for the glory of Aten is superior to wandering across Deathlands. Once you have your audience with Akhenaten and receive your Aten name and so on.
When do we meet your Pharaoh?
What's an Aten name?
What do you mean by so on?
You will meet Akhenaten at a time of his choosing. Your Aten name comes with the makeover, so you will live among us in the ideal form. The color of your hair and skin must be changed by dye and by stain.
The very thought of these gray locks of mine dyed black and done up in the Egyptian style makes me incontinent.
No need to worry, old one. Your advanced age excuses you from that part of the makeover. And there is little point in subjecting you to it.
Thanks.
You two men will follow me.
Ewat minced his way into an adjacent room. Ryan, JB, Doc, and Mildred all exchanged dubious glances. Then JB and Ryan walked into a small room, holding only two wooden tubs. They brimmed with a dark liquid. Ceramic jugs and big sponges lay on the floor.
Climb in.
What is that shit?
As I thought I explained, it will convey upon you the color of Aten.
Don't worry, guys. It's just some kind of vegetable dye. The stain isn't permanent.
JB took off his spectacles, placing them carefully on a wall shelf, stripped off the kilt, and stepped into a tub. He sat with the liquid sloshing around him and grimaced. After another moment of hesitation, Ryan followed suit. Only JB's hair needed darkening, though both he and Ryan were forced to endure soaking for an hour in the tubs of oily brown liquid, with Ewat sponging their backs, necks, and faces.
After Ewad announced that enough time had passed, they stepped out of the tubs and into calf-length, apron-like garments, identical to the ones worn by the men in the compound. When they returned to the room, Doc and Mildred couldn't help but be amused. JB was the most changed and bore the brunt of the hilarity.
Speaking strictly as a man who never wore a skirt in his life, John Barrymore, I must say that you strike a very fetching picture.
Ewat beamed at them proudly, as if they were his creations. He clapped his hand sharply, and Baldy 1 and Baldy 2 stepped in immediately.
You are assigned a food preparation station in the palace.
I'm a doctor, not a hash slinger.
You have nothing to say about it. Escort her there.
The shaved-headed man grasped her roughly by her upper arm. JB instantly stood toe-to-toe with the much larger man, glaring up into his face.
Take your bastard hand off her. I swear I'll feed you your balls.
Baldy One glanced quizzically toward Ewat, who stared back with wide, disconcerted eyes.
Tell him to do it, or you'll have a hell of a mess to clean up in here.
The last was directed toward Baldy Two, who looked as if he were considering the wisdom of pouncing on JB.
It is against the rules. I cannot allow this insolence.
Yeah. Don't start a fight you can't win, One-Eye.
Draping a comradely arm over Ewat's shoulders, Ryan bent his arm sharply, hooking Ewat's soft neck in the crook of his elbow.
Allow it just this once. This may be a fight we can't win, but you'll die first. Get me?
Really, sir?
Baldy One slowly removed his hand. JB and Mildred embraced and kissed. Then she turned to the door, the guard falling into step behind her.
You are assigned to transportation maintenance.
Gentlemen.
Doc departed with a quiet dignity, despite Baldy 2 nearly treading on his heels.
Now us.
You will join a pyramid work detail. Shift 2. The men's barracks are through there. Shall I go with you to make sure you're properly settled?
No, thanks. You've done enough for us already.
They walked through a series of small chambers and stopped before a door. A young aproned man with a sheathed dagger at his hip stood beside it. He swung it open upon their approach and gestured grandly for them to enter. JB and Ryan stepped into a long, low-ceilinged hall, so long that its far end seemed to run away in the distance. When their eyes adjusted to the murk, they saw a dormitory, a barracks with pallets laid out and facing rows on the stone floor. Many of the pallets were occupied. Many more weren't. The two men moved down the wide aisle between the pallets.
Do we just grab a rack at random and sack out?
There's got to be an overseer or boss around here someplace.
A fat, repellent figure shambled toward them from the dark end of the aisle. He wasn't very tall, but he was two men wide. A huge paunch swelled out over the top of his breech clout. His head was shaved except for a wispy strand of hair on the left side of his head. His flabby pectorals gleamed with a combination of oil and sweat. Touching the butt of a wooden truncheon hanging from his broad belt, he stopped before JB and Ryan.
You newcomers?
Yeah.
I'm Shukeli, sort of the warden around here. You're on the noon to sundown shift, block moving detail. You got a couple of hours yet. Follow me.
Shukeli lumbered back in the direction from which he'd come. JB and Ryan followed him for what seemed like a very long time. Finally, the man stopped in an area so shrouded in shadow it was only a few gray degrees above pitch black. Shukeli pointed to a pair of frayed pallets on the floor.
There you go. This is as good a place as any.
It appears we have this good place all to ourselves.
It's private, all right. Nice and quiet back here.
And dark.
And dark. Sometimes men need the dark. Need it private. I know you know what I mean.
Sure.
Ryan hit him as hard as he could in the middle of his swag belly. Shukeli doubled up, clutching at his middle. As the man fought to get breath into his lungs, Ryan reached out and ran a finger under his double chins, up to his ear. He pinched the lobe savagely, twisting at the same time. Then he leaned down and whispered into his ear.
And I know you know what I mean, you stupid bastard. We're not interested in your blue boy pastimes. Keep that in mind and we'll get along fine for the short time we're here. You don't keep that in mind and you die. Understand?
Yes.
Good. Let us know when it's time for our shift. The warden tried to straighten, but opted to remain in a slightly stooped posture as he shambled away on unsteady legs.
We're not winning any popularity contests in the holy city of Aten.
Good. I'd be a hell of a lot more worried if we were. When Ryan and JB followed the workers out of the barracks at the afternoon period of labor, they received a distinct surprise. Near the end of the long line of aproned men, they marched out of the walled compound and into open ground. They looked up at the Great Pyramid, a man-made mountain gleaming white and awesome in the noonday sun. Both he and the armorer gaped at the most massive and finely engineered structure they had ever seen.
It's got to be 400 feet tall and about 700 feet square at its widest point. God only knows how many millions of blocks there are.
Actually, once a capstone is put in place, it'll be 481 feet tall. 756 square. There are probably about 2 million blocks. It's designed to be an exact duplicate of the Great Pyramid of Cheops at Giza. For an uneducated guest, you didn't do too badly. You got a good eye. Maybe you should be working with the Royal Architects.
How long have you been working on it? 10 years at least.
Nah, just a little over two.
Bullshit. I don't know old Egypt from old eggs, but I know it took at least a generation to build the original pyramid.
Yeah, longer probably, but Pharaoh expanded on the original construction techniques. I've been working at the site since it was staked out. My name is Fassa.
Is that your real name or your Aten name?
Since I live in Aten, I guess Fassa is my real name.
When they drew closer to the enormous megalith, Ryan and JB saw the double-railed track extending out of the compound and stretching upward, supported by a complex and very solid-looking framework of beams and cross-braces. The angle of the track's incline was gentle and gradual, eventually leading up to the very apex of the pyramid. The metal cubes rolled along their caster-like wheels, drawn by a heavy winch and pulley device attached to a pair of scaffolds on the side of the structure, one above the track, one below it. Men operated the winches by turning long crank handles. It required 10 minutes to climb to the top of the pyramid, scaling a stair sunk into the stone block facade. By the time they reached it, they were perspiring heavily. At that height, the sun seemed only an arm's length away. A brisk-looking overseer bustled up to Ryan and JB.
You're the newcomers. Get to work removing the blocks from the molds.
Ryan glanced at JB, who shrugged, and both turned to obey. To their surprise, the labor wasn't quite as backbreaking or as dangerous as they supposed. A fresh wind played over the top of the pyramid, which helped to offset a little of the debilitating heat. Through close observation and by asking a few questions, they came to understand not only the basic engineering theory, but the construction techniques and materials. The building blocks for the pyramid weren't slavishly quarried and hauled, they were cast on the spot. The key of the process involved the aluminum and silicon that made up common clays. When alkali, a common substance in the desert, was added in the right proportion, the aluminum bonded tightly to both the oxygen and silicon in the clay. Pharaoh had developed a powder containing silicon and aluminum that, when added to an alkali-saturated liquid, formed a molecular glue. Limestone and granite were stirred into the mixture and poured into a mold. The acidic sap from cactus dissolved the larger pieces of limestone. Exposed to a low heat for a few hours, the putty-like substance became stone.
Ancient Egyptian stonemasons understood mineral chemistry enough to transform stone into a plastic moldable compound. After all, the Egyptians knew enough food chemistry to make wine, beer, and vinegar, and their embalming techniques are proof that they understood body chemistry, too.
Ryan and JB's assigned task was to roll the metal-walled molds containing the dried casing blocks and put them into proper position. The sides of the cubes were equipped with small hinges. Once the block was in place, the mold was easily removed, joining the block with the other so precisely that there was barely a hairbreadth in between.
The center of the pyramid is hollow, comprising a grand gallery and several chambers honeycombed with crawl spaces and air shafts.
Something else they learned over the course of that hot, sweaty afternoon was how little the laborers resented their servitude. Building the monument to Pharaoh, their god-king, left them with no other responsibilities than obeying orders, and they were essentially content with that. What happens when the pyramid is completed?
There'll be a great ceremony and celebration. Pharaoh will drink in the sacrum energy drawn down from Osiris by the pyramid.
I mean, what will you and the others do? Don't you want to be free?
I wouldn't like that. Who would take care of me? How would I get food? I like to eat, don't you?
Ryan considered the query rhetorical, so he didn't bother with a response. The sun didn't begin its decline until well after 7 o'clock. At least JB estimated that was the time, since their krons had been confiscated with the rest of their belongings.
Cease working!
Like automatons, the laborers stopped working and lined up at the stair. As before, they marched down, two men across. In some ways, the descent was more difficult than the ascent, because the shadows had thickened. One misstep could result in a bone-breaking fall. Deep twilight darkened the sky when Ryan and JB set their sandaled feet on solid ground again. They marched back into the walled compound toward the dormitory. Shikali stood by the door, and when he saw them, he beckoned for them to step out of formation.
Not you. Just one eye here.
JB hesitated, but when Ryan nodded to him, he stepped back into line and was swept out of sight by the column of marching men.
Payback plan or what?
Someone wants to see you. Come with me.
Shikali turned and walked along the side of the barracks, not bothering to check if Ryan was following him or not. Ryan caught up with him before he turned the corner, senses on full alert, muscles tensing and tightening. Rather than the ambush he expected, he saw a large pavilion erected in an open lot. Banners fluttered from poles driven into the ground near the entrance.
In there, the Royal Architect's office.
Why does the Royal Architect want to see me?
How do I know? I was told to fetch you, I fetched you. Do what you want from here on out.
With a surprising quickness for one so bulky, Shikali turned smartly on his toes and stalked away in the direction they had come. Ryan studied the pavilion suspiciously, seeing no sign of movement in or around it. A single light burned from within. He strode purposefully forward, thrusting aside the door flap. A brass lamp suspended from a support pole cast the interior with a wavery yellow illumination. Directly beneath the lamp, seated at a paper-covered table, was the hard bronze figure of Akhenaten. He looked up as Ryan entered, and even at a distance, his crimson eyes shone like baleful flames. He wore a simple brown leather belted jerkin that bore a disc worked in gold thread upon the breast. His head was bare, and he was completely alone. Ryan crossed the dozen feet separating him from the giant man of bronze.
You're the Royal Architect?
Among my other functions, would you consider this our second or third meeting, Cotter?
What do you want?
No need to be afraid, Cotter. If I wanted you dead, vultures would be feasting on your liver by now.
I'm not afraid of you, Hell Eyes.
I have been called that many, many years, and then not to my face.
I asked you a question. What do you want?
I have everything I want. An empire, a dynasty.
Except a queen to share it with.
You're far more astute than I gave you credit for. Perhaps a brain does lurk inside that grubber's shell. You're right, Carter. I have no queen. You can help me rectify that.
How?
I want you to tell Christy Roth that you understand she and I are fated to be together, and you are releasing her from whatever vow she may have made to you. In exchange for that, I will grant you and your companion safe conduct back to the redoubt and the gateway. I will give you anything you need. My proposition amuses you.
Deeply. I thought you were some kind of super mind muty. Why don't you just mentally force me to do your bidding? Could it be that Christy would instantly sense that you had me in your power and tell you what I'm telling you now? To go fuck yourself?
The shock was so unexpected, so terrible, that Ryan nearly collapsed. Time, space, the universe darkened and turned. The surroundings shattered into a kaleidoscope of flying fragments. He drifted among them. The swirling fragments coalesced into the same image, infinitely repeated. A grinning, malevolent skull, the fires of hell erupting from the eye sockets. Ryan had engaged in hundreds of battles in his life, but never one where a powerful will tried to beat down his spirit. But the image of Christy and Dean were his anchors in reality. Ryan forced himself to stare at the hundreds of thousands of fiendish, grinning skulls. His love for Christy and his son was a chain that a psychic assault couldn't break. He willed the skulls to fade, demanding that the world steady around him.
Quite suddenly, he was in the pavilion again, standing before Akhenaten.
You stinking scavenger. You dung beetle of a man. I could kill you where you stand. Give you a cerebral hemorrhage. Cause your aorta to burst.
Why don't you do it then? You won't do it because Christy will know. And if she doesn't hate you now, she will when she finds out.
Listen to me, Carter. I was created to impose order on chaos. All of man's old social arrangements were destroyed. Lawlessness, terror, anarchy run unchecked. Only my vision and my resolve can prevail to restore a measure of peace and harmony on the world.
By imposing a new form of terror.
Don't goad me. I don't really expect you, a wandering, landless killer, to understand a fraction of my dream. A dynasty dedicated to virtue, as my namesake was dedicated to peace and justice. It is the only rational means to bring order out of chaos.
I've heard similar speeches before. Distill it all down, and it's nothing more than a cheap justification for tyranny.
You're a fool. A venal, dirt-grubbing scavenger.
And you're just another fucking mutie with an attitude.
Ryan shot out his left leg in a sweeping kick that caught the underside of the table and heaved it upward into Akhenaten's face. He and the camp chair tipped over. The one-eyed man was atop him in a shaved slice of a second, his warrior reflexes and fury driving him forward, knees slamming solidly into the man's flat stomach. He pistoned both fists into the bronzed face beneath him in a flurry of jabs and left and right hooks. Akhenaten's head rocked back and forth under the steady tattoo, blood springing from his nostrils, flying from split lips.
Come on, Pharaoh! Give me a cerebral hemorrhage!
Akhenaten tried to exchange punches with Ryan, but his flailing fists missed their weaving target, or rebounded from his forearms. He bucked beneath Ryan, his hands darting for the one-eyed man's throat. As a bronze hand closed around his throat, Ryan tried first to poke his fingers into Akhenaten's eyes, but the giant straightened his arm, and his hands couldn't reach him. Akhenaten flung him aside as if he were a dummy stuffed with straw. He landed flat on his right side, the impact knocking what little breath he had out through his nostrils and mouth. He lay where he had been tossed, his face against the ground, trying to cough, trying to breathe, trying to move. Through the blurry vision of his eye, he saw Akhenaten stagger to his feet. Blood streamed from a score of wounds all over his body, his face a battered mask. Akhenaten touched his lacerated lip, frowned at the crimson wetness shining on his fingertips.
I underestimated you, Carter. You held your own in a face-to-face with me. I'll be damned. You actually hurt me.
Good.
No matter. I lived so long with pain, I no longer really feel it.
Ryan got his hands under him and pushed. The pavilion swayed around him. He stumbled erect.
Why didn't you use your psi powers on me? Give me a hemorrhage or burst my heart, like you said you could do.
You were ready for me to try that. Your strength of will is greater than I initially figured. If a mind is strong enough, consciously resisting me, I can't do much more than inflict a headache.
So, you're not quite up to the superhuman specs of Mission Invictus.
Actually, I am. My bones are denser. My circulatory system is far more efficient than yours. I probably have 3 times your strength, as you found out. I have control over my body's autonomic functions and reflexes. I've already stopped the bleeding and nipped any chance of infection. I'll be fully healed by tomorrow. You won't be able to say the same.
What now? Public execution for daring to lay hands on Pharaoh?
That's the act of a coward, Carter. No. You've made this a personal situation between us when it could have been a simple exchange. Torture, I think, is more appropriate.
Torture isn't the act of a coward?
Not the way I'll torture you. Hear my words and believe what I say. Christy will be my queen. I just have to persuade her a little less subtly than I intended. In 2 days, the capstone of my pyramid will be placed. There will be a ceremony, culminating in our marriage, and she'll agree to it. By the time the ceremony is over, the only thing she'll care about is how soon and how many royal heirs I can plant in her belly.
I'll enjoy the seating, Carter. And so will she. I'll make sure of it. Get back to your barracks, Carter. You'll be hurting tomorrow. But consider yourself the most fortunate dung beetle who ever lived. You went toe-to-toe with a god and lived to regret it.